This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I don't think I'm coming in tomorrow. Everything seems to be pottering along. Oh, and it is a gorgeous day today. Spring has finally come. I don't know what the temperature is. Just gonna glance at my phone real quick here. 69 degrees. Yay. So yeah, we finally made it out of all that snow and everything else, and I may need to say hello to somebody here. I just wave at him as he goes by. He's not gonna look at me. Guy I've known for a long time. I didn't realize he was still working at headquarters. A lot of good people at my major client. Dedicated people. People who are trying to make things work. Trying to move things forward. Good people. I've got some good work done this week. And we're puttering along. I think we're on target for the next beta release of the little website that we put together for financial information. That seems to be going on fine. We did some polishing, got all our reports done this week. So that's all good, and we're starting to look towards the next things that we have to do. Moving some pieces around to get those, and it looks like there may be a ambulance coming our way. There is an ambulance coming our way. You'll hear it on the podcast. And there it went. One of the fun things about growing up overseas is things like that bring back memories. Like in the Philippines. In the Philippines, people didn't necessarily pull out of the way for ambulances. Sometimes they didn't, sometimes they did. That was the first thing. So a lot of times the ambulance would actually have to cross over and go against traffic. So the people would get out of the way. So they would actually cross over into the wrong lane and drive over there so they could make through. And then other times what would happen is the ambulance would go tearing by, and inevitably somebody would turn in and duck in behind the ambulance and rev it up and go flying along behind the ambulance because they could get someplace faster. Because the Filipinos, at least when I was there, aren't so much rule-based as they are opportunity-based. So if there's an opportunity, they're pretty much gonna take it. I've told the story before about my dad getting to the Philippines and him riding with a local pastor and coming up to a stoplight when it was later at night with no cars around and the guy just driving right through the stoplight. And my dad is telling him, "Well, brother, that light was red." "Well, yeah." He said, "Oh, Brother Farron," he said, "you didn't actually expect me to sit there with no cars coming, did you?" He said, "I'd look foolish." So, you know, if there's an opportunity to go, we're gonna go. Get in front of a window where there's supposed to be an organized line up to the window. Nobody pays attention to the line. They all just kind of shove up to the front. So there's this big crowd around the window. You just kind of have to kind of push your way in. Everybody's looking for an opportunity. Great way to grow up. Get a chance to see how other cultures do things. Everything's going to work. Everything's puttering along. I think we're fine. We're where we need to be. Getting some new development projects underway at this point since we're wrapping up this one. Analysis for the new projects is going a little slower, but simply because the people that I need the analysis from are just really busy. They're busy, 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 busy. So we may have to come up with a different strategy there. To quote President Bush, former President Bush, I should say. But we'll see. We'll see. It'll all work out. Works out. In other news, the books finally arrived. The beta copies arrived. I got them ordered. They have arrived. I'm in the process of distributing them. I did post what I thought was a little funny on Facebook because I had been monitoring the progress of the books on the website that I use, createspace.com. And I was chagrined that, in fact, they weren't going to hit their suggested deadline, which is usually very generous, which is a good idea. They always give themselves very generous deadlines, so it's easy for them to hit them. And so they had said when I ordered that the expected delivery date would be yesterday. I was like, okay, great. And what I will do is I'll get envelopes and I'll package them all up on Wednesday, put them in the mail on Thursday. We'll be good. It'll be good. So I'm watching on the site and I'm going to my order and I'm watching and it keeps saying in production, in production, in production, in production. I'm waiting for it to change like order completed, waiting for shipping or shipped or whatever. In production, in production. By Tuesday night, it still said in production. I thought, well, there's no way I'm getting these books tomorrow. It's going to be Thursday or Friday before these books are in. So I got on Facebook and said, okay, sorry, sorry, sorry. Doesn't look like the books are going to be here. And I think I had checked it. I think I had checked it on Wednesday morning, too, just to see. Nothing, nothing, nothing. So when I got home, the books were out. I imagine it's loud in that car if it's coming all the way through open windows. At least it's nice music. Anyways, I had gotten home, and the books were all stacked up there in front of my garage. What? And sure enough, the box, it was them. I didn't think it was them at first, but sure enough, it was them. They had gotten there on Wednesday, which is where they were supposed to do. And I thought, well, what? So then I got down in my basement and I was checking my email. They had sent me an email at like 2:30 in the afternoon. We've shipped your books. And by 5 o'clock, I had them. So either they have a really incredible delivery service, which in the future we might have, you know, drones or transportation devices, something. Transporter devices. Either they have really incredible transportation, or I think they're a little behind on their actual notifications. So, needless to say, I didn't ship them out last night, but I did get them all signed last night, get prepped, and then this morning I ran to the store and got some envelopes, and so I got that under control, and then tonight I'm going to go ahead and get them all packaged up and maybe, maybe, maybe get a little writing done tonight. That would be good. Although there are activities on the docket, I think, for tonight already. So I might not get any writing done, but that's okay. I started writing on the new book on Sunday, and I made plenty of progress, actually, technically already this week. So I'll still have Friday and Saturday to go. And frankly, the new book, which I think finally I have settled on the title for. First it was A Seed in Secret, and that title is getting bounced forward to the next book. And then second, it was The Shut Door, but it feels like I'm starting to get hiccups. It was The Shut Door, but then as I got looking at it, I thought, no, that's not quite right. So I think it's The Narrow Door now, or The Narrow Gate. Although the parable I want to use is the narrow door, not the narrow gate. So it probably will be the narrow door. And the parable is an interesting parable. It's not a parable we talk about. If I said the narrow gate, everybody would recognize that as something that Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, when he said, "There's for straight is the gate, and narrow is the way that leads to life, but broad is, wide is the gate, and broad is the path that leads to destruction." But that's not actually the parable I'm going to be working with. There's another parable in Luke 12 that it's a pretty interesting parable because Jesus kind of rocks some people back on their heels with the parable, in that he's traveling around and he is he's doing the teaching of the kingdom and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's Luke 13, I think. Luke 13, yeah, the narrow door. And some people ask him, as he's teaching, someone says, "Lord, will those who are saved be few?" In other words, is it only going to be us that make it? And one might wonder if the person who was asking the question might have a sense of satisfaction about it. And Jesus answers in a very interesting way. He says, "Strive to enter through the narrow door, for many, I tell you, will seek to enter and will not be able to. Once the master of the house has risen and shut the door, and you begin to stand outside and to knock at the door, saying, 'Lord, open to us,' then he will answer you, 'I do not know where you come from.'" Which is an interesting phrase. I got to do some more research on that. "I do not know where you come from. Then you will begin to say, 'Well, we ate and drank in your presence, and you taught in our streets.' But he will say, 'I tell you, I do not know where you come from. Depart from me, all you workers of evil.' In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, when you see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, but you yourself cast out. And people will come from east and west, from north and south, and recline at the table in the kingdom of God. And behold, some are last who will be first, and some are first who will be last." And what's interesting about that is it's that, to me, it sounds like that the person who is asking the question, "Are those who are saved, will they be few?" is wanting reinforcement for the old colloquialism, "It's just us four and no more." And Jesus is saying to them, that may be your attitude, and there's many others with that attitude, but the fact is you aren't going to make it. That you need to be striving right now to live your lives in a way that you aren't going to make it, because this idea of there's just a few of us that are going to make it in is wrong-headed. That in fact there are going to be many who will make it in. The prophets and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and people from all over the world are going to make it in because they strove to make it in. And you thought, because of where you are and because of your position and because you thought of people as us versus them, you aren't going to make it. And that's an interesting idea. That even though when we think we're in the club, that we need to be careful about how we conduct ourselves, about the baggage that we carry in. And that's actually the nursery rhyme I think I'm still going to use for want of a nail. Although, I may look around and see. I've got a thing in the back of my head, a little pinging. And I've learned that when I get pings in the back of my head that I should just take a second look. I had one of those things happen this week. One of my beta readers, who actually has a quote on the back cover of the first book, Windfall, the 99 and 1, I hadn't heard from her as a beta reader. And so I thought, well, maybe she got busy. She doesn't have time. You know, that's fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. Because I try not to pressure people into anything, you know. So the ranks were filling up, and last night we were down to 2 or 3 books left. And I just thought, you know, you should just get an extra book. And so I went ahead and manually cranked down the inventory so I wouldn't completely sell out. Had another hand. I went ahead and wrote her, and I said, hey, I said, no pressure, but, you know, you seem to enjoy the book. I don't currently have you on the beta list, or do you want to be on the beta list? And she wrote back, and she said, oh, yeah, absolutely. I thought I was on it. And so we had just had a little miscommunication. But, you know, those little whispers, and I'm getting a little whisper that maybe the parable, the For Want of a Nail, maybe it's not the right time for this one. So I've got to review some other. I may do that tonight after I get everything kind of shipped out. And we may have a different parable for the cover. I've kind of got an idea what I want to have on the cover. And it's changed a little bit. I'm going to use my grandson on this one. Because by the time we get to the cover, he should be 2 years and May, June, July, August, September. Almost 2.5 years old. So I think he can handle it at that point. It'll be cute. So anyways, everything is puttering along. It's good. I've started the new book. It's actually flowing pretty well. I have a pretty good idea of where I'm going, and it's moving down on the page pretty fast. So, and it feels right. So that's good. Anyways. On to the topic at hand. Several weeks ago, I saw an article. I think it was referred on Facebook. Eric Metaskus wrote an article, I think for the Wall Street Journal, which sort of surprised me. And it was entitled, Science Increasingly Makes the Case for God. And, you know, it was an interesting article. I think I read at it and bookmarked it, not realizing that once I left it go for a while, that it was going to become a part of the archived articles, and I was going to have to subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. But anyways, I found another article that referred to the article, so I'm just as good. Anyways, in it, he was arguing that the parameters for human life are so precise that they are indication of God's existence. And this is a quote from his article that this other article had. Today, there are more than 200 known parameters necessary for a planet to support life, every single one of which must be perfectly met, or the whole thing falls apart. The odds against life in this universe are simply astonishing. Yet here we are, not only existing, but talking about existing. What can account for it? Can every one of those many parameters have been perfect by accident? At what point is it fair to admit that science suggests that we cannot be the result of random forces? Doesn't assuming that an intelligent created these perfect conditions require far less faith than believing a life-sustaining Earth just happened to beat the inconceivable odds to come into being? Now, okay, I've talked on the podcast before about the three waves of science. How in the first wave, you're just observing, and you're making your own models, you know, you're forming stuff in clay, you're painting pictures, you're thinking, okay, that's not that big of a deal. The second wave of science, where you begin to understand some of the internals of how life works, and it seems very complicated, and so then God is much farther away from me than I want him to be, where he seemed near on the first wave, and so in the second wave, I stiff arm him and I push him out. And then the third wave finally comes along where we realize that everything is so finely tuned and so finely balanced that we begin to really seriously consider if someone hasn't created it. And he's moving along the same route in this article. But the secondary article that I found, which I thought had some interesting things to say, was that this second author, and his name was Rabbi Joffrey Middleman, and his science was his article was, "Sorry, science doesn't make a case for God, but that's okay." So this is his viewpoint, which has some interesting points, and then it has some points that I think, oh, wait. So he says that this idea that a finely tuned universe is a compelling argument for God. He said that it is, but it's also deeply problematic. And this is why he thinks it's deeply problematic. And I think we would be good to entertain these notions. He said that, first of all, science is always changing. And so if you base your belief system on the current ideas in science, that you open yourself up for the potential to being unnecessarily dogmatic about things that have nothing to do with a true belief in God. And he gives excellent examples, like, for instance, Copernicus and Galileo. So the idea of a Copernican existence, that we were the center of the existence because we are the apple of God's eye, therefore, I'm getting my mail, everything revolves around us, and so it just makes sense that we are in the middle of this universe and everything is spinning around us, even though observations begin to show that that's not true. So when we adopt our religious beliefs in conjunction with a scientific stance, and something comes along and changes those beliefs, we have the potential to become concerned and dogmatic about things that we don't need to be concerned and dogmatic about. I mean, looking back now, it was ridiculous for the Catholic Church to be persecuting people simply because of observations that could be tested, retested, experimented with. True science. It was ridiculous for the religious people to decide they were going to make, I'm backing into my garage one moment, decide they were going to make their stand there and they were going to go out and torture people who thought that the earth revolved around the sun. That's just silly. And yet it happened. And it happened because you had an intertwining of religious belief and scientific investigation. So, I mean, there, you know, he's got a point. That's true. He said, so what would happen if we discover that the parameters for life are not quite as amazing as they seemed? Or if we discovered that humanity was not unique in the universe? If you were using science to support your religious outlook, unless you have a very sophisticated theology, you'd be in deep trouble and would need to do quite a bit of mental gymnastics. And he quotes some people, Christians Francis Collum and Carl Gilbertson warn about using fine-tuning argument, as they say, the fine-tuning argument must not be too quickly fashioned into an argument for the existence of God. Like all apologetic arguments, it can be undermined by new discoveries and weakened by broad theological conversations. In the latter category, we note that the fine-tuning of the universe is just as necessary to produce cockroaches as humans. Here we would add insights from theology that humans are made in the image of God, and our far more reasonable goal of cosmic fine-tuning than our cockroaches, but this goes beyond science. So even in talking about science as look how fine-tuned everything is, you still need to supplement that with a religious belief to come down to the existence of man. I think that's a very valid point. The second point that he makes, I think, is valid, except nobody follows it. And the second point he makes is that science and religion are two very different ways of thinking, and we shouldn't conflate them. Using science to prove God's existence confuses two very different ways of thinking, he says. Science progresses as new hypotheses get tested, questioned, refuted, expanded upon, discarded, and revised. Religion, on the other hand, is a way to make sense of the world. It is an appreciation of awe and mystery. He does say, in other words, science is a search for truth while religion is a search for meaning. There's one spot in here, though, that he said something that, something about, oh, there it is. He says, science is the best method we have for understanding how we got here. But religion isn't science. It is not, or at least it should not, be about probable, provable, or disprovable claims, because that's not its purpose. Instead, it should be designated to help us improve ourselves and our world here and now. Okay, I agree with some of that, but I'm not sure I quite agree with this idea that science is the best method we have for understanding how we got here. Simply because science, true science, is where we have new hypotheses that we can test, that are repeatable, that we can question or refute, expand upon. And the problem is, if you actually get scientists to be honest, they will tell you that really there's no way to prove origins because it's not repeatable. And the data is interpretable. You can try to string things together, but just because you had a bunch of different fossils at a bunch of different times that were similar doesn't mean that one came from the other. That's the theory. And there are other ways that things could happen. Now, some people will just say, well, no, that's ridiculous. Of course that's what happened because it's been proven. Well, okay, but what's really happening there is that you are layering on a religious belief on top of what is the scientific fact, which is the reason I said that this idea that science and religion are two separate things, which they are, but nobody treats them that way. Because those who choose a religion of atheism or agnosticism or humanism are very, very quick to latch onto any proposal that, quote unquote, proves that we don't need to have a God. So I think it is inevitable that everyone is going to look at scientific discoveries and try to figure out how to plug those scientific discoveries into their current religious beliefs. And so while I do think it's something that we should be cautious about, I think it's something that is going to happen over and over again. And honestly, for us right now, the wind is swinging our way. It's really, it is blowing our way because it just keeps getting more and more complicated to actually get life going. Now, if we had aliens showed up on the planet, would that be something we should be concerned about? Not really. Same designer that made one could make the others. If we had aliens show up that would say, oh, you know, there is no God. We've proved it. Look, we have this superior technology. We've never found God. Would that prove that there's no God? Of course not. Because you really can't prove the existence or the non-existence of God through science. You can't do it. You can always come up with a scenario where the quote-unquote evidence you have can be thwarted. It's like I've said before. If I'm in a relationship, in a friendship with someone who decides that I don't have a daughter, it is impossible for me to prove to him that I have a daughter. I could bring her. He'd say, oh, that's just some actress you hired. I could have her DNA tested, me DNA tested, and he could say, well, I don't know anything about DNA tests. You fake the results. I mean, you can't. I could have tons of people testify that she is, in fact, my daughter. And he could say, well, you just paid them all to say that. Because if you don't want to believe in something, there's no way to force someone to believe in it. Period. Which is a really interesting thing about this existence. So anyways, he did conclude by saying what religion means to him. And I think he has some good things to say. He says, for me, as I look out at the universe, I am in awe of the fact that we are living here on this earth. But that awe wouldn't change for me if the parameters for life are actually 1 in 100, rather 1 in septillion. Instead, I am guided by the words of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Just, quote, just to be a blessing. Just to be is a blessing. Just to live is holy. And the article goes on to say, I know no matter what new scientific findings arise, I will never be able to prove it. Science doesn't help make that case for me, but that's okay, because the most important thing is that I try to live it. And I think that's true. I think it's absolutely true. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.